It's time for Wonks. From the Noche Jazz Cabaret in Des Moines, Iowa, it's the monthly, just-for-fun gathering of political insiders. Now, Wonks.
Hello, and welcome to Wonks. I'm Dennis Goldford.
I'm Kevin Cooney. Once again, we are at the jazz cabaret known as Noche in lovely downtown Des Moines for our monthly humorous look at politics and more as we go behind the scenes.
This month, money and politics. Who pays the big bucks? What do they use it for? What kind of money matters in politics?
Well, we have the insiders here to tell us all about it. Let's introduce them to you now. First off, Sue Dvorsky is a longtime Democratic operative who has served as chair of the Iowa Democratic Party. Steve Kochel spent 3 decades as a political strategist, starting in legislative races and most recently the lead strategist for the Jeb Bush campaign, with a lot in between.
And Jeff Link has done everything there is to do in campaign politics, strategies, campaign director, chief of staff, from Clinton to Gore to Harkin and Obama. David Oman has been there and done that as well, starting his career as a reporter. Oman started as press secretary to Governor Robert Ray. He's the only Iowan to serve as chief of staff to 2 governors, Governor Ray and Governor Branstad. He spent 20 years as a cable TV executive. He ran for governor, at least the Republican nomination. And he was co-chair for the Mitt Romney campaign.
And he has one bitchin' TR6 at his house. I'm just saying that. And I've made offers, but no luck. And everyone knows Kathy Obradovich, the political columnist and reporter for the Des Moines Register. Let's give everybody on our panel a nice round of applause.
So, as the song says, love and marriage, horse and carriage, money and politics. You can't have one without the other. Is money a necessary evil, the power that fuels a campaign?
Or is it the easiest way to have influence, to buy influence, if you will? It may depend on whether you are a supporter or a cynic. Dave Kochel is a cynic and a supporter and a Republican. Is Republican money any different than Democratic money, David?
It's the same money. It's usually more. But I would say in the last couple of cycles, it hasn't necessarily been more. I think one of the things that I was fascinated with in 2016 was the disproportionate amount of money spent by the Hillary Clinton campaign versus Donald Trump. Now, that's one big presidential race. It doesn't really address the systemic money in politics. There is certainly more Republican money in politics than Democratic money across the board writ large. But I'm getting to the point now where I'm not even sure it matters how much money you have in politics. In a campaign like we saw in 2016, the disproportionate, you know, spending on television, on digital, on field, on mail, on virtually everything you do in a campaign to advantage yourself, Trump was well behind the Clinton campaign. And for that matter, Romney was well behind the Obama campaign. So the last 2 cycles, you've had huge Democratic spending, and you had a different outcome in each election. So money it's important, but it certainly isn't predictive. It used to be the thing that we pointed to first and most about viability, but anymore, it's a crapshoot. You can get around not having money if you've got a brand and fame and personality, or if you've got a strategy that's unusual that doesn't really require money. So money is certainly not everything in politics anymore. It's nice to get paid, though, as a consultant, as a vendor.
Jeff, what about Democratic money?
Well, it's an interesting point that David makes. I think we do have to distinguish, though, between the presidential level, statewide campaigns, and then legislative and local races, because money does matter more in those smaller races. I think David makes a very good point that in the presidential race, Trump changed all the rules. And, I think many of us use the hashtag nothing matters a lot in 2016 because nothing seemed to matter. Nothing that worked in the past ever had any semblance of reality in 2016. But if you're running for legislature, if you're running, we just had a city council race here in Des Moines. We had a Ward 3 campaign where one candidate spent over $200,000, another candidate spent $140,000. That's raising more than many congressional candidates at this point in Iowa. Like, it's crazy how much money was involved in that ward race.
David Oman.
Well, just to pick up on that, first of all, Dennis, thank you for mentioning that I ran for governor. Well,
somebody had to know.
Not a lot of people remember that.
I remember it, David. I was there.
Yep. The truth there. Is, well, I tried to hire David, but you were going off to Michigan, I think, about that time.
Well, I was busy. No,
a lot of people don't remember that. The truth is, not a lot of people knew I was running while I was running. But to make a comparison to those council numbers you just talked about, 140K, 200K, the first campaign I was involved with was Governor Ray's fourth effort in 1974. The entire all-in budget was $250,000 for a statewide race.
For governor?
For governor.
Yeah.
And people thought that was egregious. In 78, it was doubled to $500,000. And people were thinking we were raping and pillaging and raising that kind of money. And now it's a crumb compared to what these budgets are.
Kathy, from a journalist standpoint, we've heard some Democratic and Republican views, and we're certainly going to get Sue in on this, but give us an overview from a journalistic standpoint about money in politics.
Well, you asked whether money was a necessary evil, and, you know, they say the best things in life are free, but that sure as hell doesn't include political ads. It is a necessary evil, but I don't think it has to be as evil as it is today. As a journalist, one of the things that bothers me as I'm trying to report on this is how much we don't really know, or how much we don't know until it's too late about political spending. Transparency is important for voters to understand how money is fitting into these presidential races and who is paying for them. And, you know, as you look at what the money is that candidates are spending, do you really know who contributed that money? In a lot of ways, you don't. What we call dark money, which is often raised by what we call political nonprofits, they don't even have to report their donors. Others don't report them in any sort of time frame where you can tell who is paying. You know, I'm not saying, well, Donald Trump said, you know, he said, well, you know, of course the donors want something. Of course they want something. It doesn't mean they're going to get what they want. But it does mean that perhaps you, who have just as many votes as the head of a super PAC, don't have as much access or influence to the candidates. So that is something I think we ought to be talking about.
Sue, when we were talking earlier, you told us a very interesting story in your early days soliciting money from a major donor.
Well, because one of the things, first of all, I don't ever like to characterize this as a necessary evil. This is a business. It's not evil. Here's the difference between David and Dave's money and Jeff's and my money. We feel guilty about ours. We hate asking for it. We feel like there's something slightly unseemly about it. These guys love their donors. They just go for it. So they get it, and they don't have to, like, agonize for months about how they got it. When I came to be chair, my first term of my own was in 2011, and we were not in great shape in our party. And I was a retired school teacher from Iowa City, and the big donors in Polk County did not know who I was. I did not know that I was a salesperson. I had been a teacher for more than 35 years. So I went to one of our big donors, and we only have about 10 in Iowa.
We have, you want to mention any names?
Well, three of them
we
are probably
10?
In here.
I can only count about four.
Okay, we got eight. We have four big ones, and then like seven, you know. So I was in with one of the big ones. And, of course, I was scared to death. I had gone and bought a new jacket. I had new shoes. I was such a wreck. So I went in there. I'm like, sir, here's the thing. You're in the investor class, and I'm not. So I have to assume that, you know, you've made investments in the past that haven't worked out. And I know that 2010 thing, not so much with the payback. But I'm telling you that I got a plan, and if you invest in me in this party, so I'm going on, and I'm a junior high special ed teacher. If I don't get feedback, I just keep going. And I, you know, Norm Sturzenbach sitting there all twitchy, and I can't stop because I'm scared to death. And I'm watching his assistant start snickering at me. And finally, I take a breath, and he says to me, you know, little girl, I'll tell you this. I know, but I took it because I'll tell you what, I would have crawled across broken glass. I needed that money so bad. Little girl, you're going to have to take a breath and let me say yes. And I'm like, yes, that is the best lesson ever. But this money is not a necessary evil. Money is necessary. This is a business enterprise. We pay consultants because they have expertise. They're professionals. We pay staff and field organizers because they have expertise. They're professionals. You know, gone are the days when, you know, we were running Bob Dvorsky's first house race from his mother and father's kitchen table, and we were throwing walking decks. Those of you, there are some in the room who will understand the reference. Andrew Brow, you will not. But that's not how it works now. This is, the stakes are high. It requires professionalism, and you pay for professionals. So that's one thing. I think.
Well, let me bring in the professor here, you know, and, you know, you probably wrote a book on this or something at some time or another, Dennis, but what changed? When did it change? Because didn't it used to be that, like, party money, you raised money for the party, or it doesn't seem like it was such a candidate thing. Were there, was this before primaries? What happened? When did this all seem to shift? Because it wasn't the same as I remember as a young college student studying political science.
Well, you know, I was in graduate school at the University of Chicago, and despite these extraordinarily youthful looks, I was there during the latter stages of the Daley administration, the first Mayor Daley. And of course, then they would have slate making. If you wanted to run for dog catcher, you'd have to go before the party committee that would decide whether you could have the party label or not. And that depended upon whether you worked hard for the party, you were a precinct worker, you got the vote out, you took care of people's problems when they had issues with garbage collection and streetlights and so forth, and then they'd slate you for a particular office. So the party controlled the nominations. But what changed in the 1960s, or at the end of the 60s into the 1970s, was, along with two other significant changes I'll mention more briefly, was what political scientists call the rise of the independent political entrepreneur. And with primaries becoming the main way that you became nominated for state office or for local office, and certainly for the presidential level, instead of the old days in which the organization would look for a suitable candidate, now people who thought of running for offices as candidates went out and had to build their own organizations. That took money. That took a lot of money. So that was the main emphasis, the main change in our electoral process that fragmented everything and made everybody having to raise money for himself and on his own, which, of course, lessened party loyalty. More quickly, the two other major changes was, first of all, in communications, the rise of television. Television is extremely expensive. It pays bills for all sorts of people who are anchors and reporters
Thank
and so
you.
Forth. You're welcome. Now, it'll be interesting to see how that changes with the internet and micro-targeting now that our folks here may talk about in a bit. But the other main change in terms of money was a Supreme Court case in the 1970s called Buckley versus Vallejo. And that basically was a case in which the Supreme Court said that essentially money counts as speech within the meaning of the First Amendment. So if somebody wants to donate money or contribute money, you can only regulate that in certain ways, if at all, because that's that person's political speech. They said that's protected by the First Amendment. So that opened the door to what eventually became Citizens United.
Okay. Well,
which opened the whole garage door.
Right.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, the other sort of big factor, and David, tell me if you agree with this, was McCain-Feingold. Right? That was landmark legislation.
Explain that for the folks at home.
Okay, so McCain-Feingold was campaign finance reform legislation in the late 90s. And essentially what it did was it took power away from giving money to the parties and created these independent groups, right? And Kathy alluded to dark money. This was the beginning of the rise of the independent group and the rise of moving money outside of the party, which both parties in the 90s were sort of accountable. And then it moved everything to independent groups, which are not accountable to anyone except the donors who support those groups. And I think that was one of the biggest shifts in the whole campaign finance infrastructure. And I was working, I was Harkin's chief of staff at the time, and I said to him, you should not vote for this. He's like, well, this is campaign finance reform. I'm for campaign finance reform. I said, this is the worst piece of legislation ever. You should vote against it. And he voted for it. And I think in hindsight, he looks back at it and said, yeah, this really destroyed the party system.
Yeah. Kathy Obradovich.
One of the reasons why we should all care about that is that when it comes to deciding who's going to run in primaries, the party doesn't really have much power anymore over, you know, a member of Congress to say, you know, they're not going to decide, you know, who's going to run in a primary. It's these special interest groups who don't really care about getting anything done in Congress as long as they can keep raising money off of whatever ideological issue they have. And we have these on both sides of the aisle. And that is one of the reasons why we have so much gridlock today.
Those may be wise purchases or not, depending on your perspective, the PAC money that is being spent. What were some of the unwise decisions, unwise money decisions, Jeff and Dave?
The Iowa straw poll.
That's the whole thing?
That's my first big stupid waste of money. Was Mitt Romney in 2007 spending $4 million to win about 1,500 votes in the straw poll, which then set his expectations so high that he had to win the caucuses. It also eliminated Sandy Brownback.
What did he have to spend to win the caucuses?
Yeah, a lot. it then eliminated Sam Brownback, which was the only person that could hold down Mike Huckabee, who rose like a phoenix and won on, you know, old, you know, jokes about cooking up squirrels into popcorn poppers, you know.
How did you spend that much money on a straw poll? I mean, it's pretty much an isolated audience, isn't it?
Well, no. Steve Forbes set the record before us. It's not like we were the only ones. It was the first time that I made the decision to blow $4 million for nothing. But it was a long tradition, and you know, it's a lot of the reason is because of people like Kathy and David Yepsen and others who were the prognosticators trying to set expectations in the caucuses. And, well, so Democrats had their JJ dinner, and we had our straw poll, and you had to have this showing. And if you didn't have a certain showing and meet expectations in that showing, you weren't going to be viable. And the Sunday shows talked about it in Washington, and it reverberated all around the political infrastructure around the country. So you know, we held ourselves into this system that you really couldn't control. I mean, we could do enough to control winning the straw poll in 2007, but it set into practice a bunch of events that we couldn't control. So I skipped it 4 years later and instead just went to the state party chairman and said, I'll raise you $100,000.
Just for the record, Dave, yeah. I just want to say I've always been on the, well, maybe at least long been on the record as saying the straw poll was stupid money and that the party should get rid of it. So,
but you're right about it.
But you're right that we did write about it. Mm-hmm.
Just Sue quick. Sue Dvorsky wanted to check in just for a second. Though.
One of the things that Dave said that was the critical word, it's control. So, you know, pre-64, Ed Skinner, God rest his soul, said this to me when I first met him. He said, oh, honey, boy, in 63, I could have done everything for you, and now I can't do anything. Because there is a line somewhere between smoke-filled rooms in both parties of people who really have a vested interest in picking whoever the candidate's going to be, and a wide-open Wild West primary of people who don't understand that the smart play would have been to let Brownback, I mean, you know, in some circles, that the smart play would have been a political long game. And so you've got this tension between, you know, 10 people who really know what's going on for a long play making a pick, that's no good, and wide-open Wild West to people who really don't know what they're doing, that's no good either. And so it's control where the money goes.
The link between that smoke-filled room and the wild, wild west, as you put it, is the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968. Yes. Because after that disaster, people wanted to open up the parties for more participation and not have these smoke-filled rooms dominate things. But that's what led to the increase in the primary system, where, as you said, there is a lack of control. And in terms of the money spent at the straw poll, the last one, I have this factoid in my head. There were, at the time, roughly, and this was the 2011 straw poll, wasn't it, the last one, here up in Ames, Iowa. There were about, at the time, roughly 600,000 registered Republicans in the state of Iowa. I think the total vote in that straw poll was 16,800-something. And what this less than 10%, maybe less than 5% or so of registered Republicans, what they did there had a huge impact on that race.
David Oman. Yeah, I was going to ask you, too, just real quickly, I know you weren't state co-chair at this particular time, but wasn't one of the big problems with this straw poll that people were critical, they were taking a double dip? I mean, it wasn't just a publicity double dip, but it was a financial double dip for the party. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, Iowa was taking a double dip, and some of us figured that it was more important that we keep the caucuses, right, than hang on and cling to the straw poll. And every 4 years at the DNC and RNC, we have to fight through that, and it was harder on our side to fight through it when we had one bite of the apple and then another one. You're talking about who reaped the money from the straw poll. I'd say that was nominal in the greater scheme of things. What I'd like to open up, to borrow your phrase, Dennis, is this conversation. We're talking tonight about money, and a lot of people probably correctly say a plague on both of your houses. Money isn't everything. I've always said for decades that 60, 70, at times 80% of a campaign is a great candidate. And then you support, that candidate has to support him or herself with adequate financing, maybe really good financing. Most of all, you got to have a great message. And in this state, because we're a caucus state, even more than a primary, you got to have a good organization. So Huckabee beat Mitt because he may have had a corny message, but he related to people, and he had a pretty darn good organization. Bernie Sanders, in your party just last time, was dwarfed by Hillary on the money front, but he had a message that resonated and put together a heck of an organization. So it isn't all about money.
Well, Dave or Dave, tell us about the Ernst campaign.
Oh, tell us both, please, because you both worked on it. You were the finance director, David Oman, of the Ernst campaign, and Dave Kochel, your function was strategist, chief strategist?
Oh, I was a volunteer.
Tweeter in chief.
I was a volunteer.
But it's very interesting. I think most people are probably familiar with the meteoric rise. But tell us how that.
I'll start. I mean, first of all, we were in a primary with Mark Jacobs, who's a wonderful guy, a successful guy from Des Moines originally, had made his money at Goldman Sachs and in Houston, heading up an energy company, came back, spent ultimately $4 million to win a primary, which if you asked any of us put together a primary budget, we could probably do it for $600,000-$700,000 for a campaign like that, or maybe $1 million.
David Kochel has never done a primary less than $2 million.
Oh, yes, I have. Joni Ernst was much less than $2 million.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah. Her money didn't come in until June.
Right.
Yeah. Well, no, we did that campaign on $400,000 and a really, really great ad. So That campaign was a candidate who was disciplined and focused, who had a message, who was different than the four other men she was running with, and who, by the way, nobody knew this at the time, had already gotten the NRA endorsement, the Chamber of Commerce endorsement, tacitly the Koch brothers, even though they didn't have a group that could endorse her at that point, and Sarah Palin. But so she had basically united the entire coalition without really anybody knowing it. And then that happened in early March. Then Bruce Braley said a couple of really dumb things. And then we launched the Squeal ad. And all of that, in the course of about a week, turned that campaign into rocket fuel. And we raised, I think, most of the money. After that point, I think we'd raised about $250,000 up until that March date. So you can win a primary with less. You've got to get real lucky.
Between March and June?
I'll give you the numbers. Okay.
Yeah, you probably have it. We didn't have we didn't have $2 million for the primary. I'll tell you that for sure.
Well, David Oman. I'll give you a personal perspective. I looked at that race and at some of the candidates. Joni and I met in December. I wasn't persuaded. Again in February, and I just loved her. And I thought that it's time for Iowa to decouple from Mississippi, and let's send a woman to Washington, D.C. And that really was a driver for me. I agreed to come along. I talked to Polyansky, you, a little bit, and you know, was doing some due diligence after basically already saying I was willing to help. And one of the questions I asked was, well, because there wasn't much, they'd raised 100 grand in the first 2 months of the year. And so I asked, well, do we have any television? Do we have anything? And the people were sort of holding their, said, well, we have this ad. I said, tell me about the ad. And it was the
tell us about the ad. There might be some people who are...
Well, it was the ad where Joni starts off by talking about when she was a kid growing up on a farm, she castrated pigs. And I'll go to Washington, D.C. and learn how to cut pork. And my response was, really? That's the ad? And so I'm going to fast track this. I agreed to do it. I grabbed a list of names. I was down in Arizona for a week watching spring training, calling people left and right. And I called back to Polyansky, and I said, nobody knows any of these people. They don't know Jacobs. They don't know Clovis. They don't know Whitaker, Young, and they sure as hell don't know Joni. And I said, when are we going to get this ad on? Even though I wasn't sure it was good. And he was doing the right thing. He said, well, we got to wait, because once we start, we got to keep a cape on to sustain the campaign. And I said, David, if you don't start, there won't be a campaign. And what happened, the time frame you mentioned is even tighter. Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. The ad started with a $6,000 cable buy in Sioux City. That was it.
$7,000.
Seven, okay. with inflation, okay. But within the same news cycle, not a week, but a day, this is where we got lucky.
So fortunate.
The Braley, the leaked Braley video from one of his own people in that closed-door meeting in Texas talking about Chuck Grassley not having a law degree, maybe becoming chair of judiciary.
It's such a coincidence that happened in
Chuck
tape was in January, and then
and it happened.
It was crazy.
Kochel didn't release it
crazy.
Until the day before the squeal ad.
And
it was just crazy.
What happened?
It's amazing.
What happened was the broadcast news stations, all of a sudden, you had an ad from one candidate,
yes.
One party,
remarkable.
One of the other.
And the news.
It became a story.
You got to be lucky sometimes.
And that's what
you know what they say about coincidences.
Yeah, better to be lucky than good.
Yeah, they take a lot of planning.
They took some planning, but it worked.
By the way, that was a super PAC coordinating with the campaign for those of you keeping score at home.
You have photos of it still, I know.
Oh, there's just so many interesting things being
said. The dynamic
said here.
Over here. I'm going to move over by you guys.
So let's, well.
The net of all that, Kevin, was Joni won the primary with the majority of the votes, which is pretty hard in a five-way race. And Fox and the Journal began to profile her and that Iowa race. And we ended up with checks not only from every county, which is predictable, but we had checks from every state. And then on election night in November, hers was the sixth pickup seat, not just turning the seat over, but giving the Republicans control.
Gentlemen and ladies, we're going to take a break. We're going to be back with more wonks and more talks after this.
Coming up, audience questions, rebellion at the register, Bernie and Donald and the destruction of party power, and celebrity fundraisers. Noche is Iowa's premier home for jazz and cabaret. Open Wednesday through Saturday and hosting performers local and national, Noche's throwback cocktail bar and stage ensure a night unlike any other in central Iowa.
Every night I just bide my time till you are with me again.
Whether it's a night out for a show or throwing your next private event backstage, visit nochedsm.com for more information right away. That's nocedsm.com.
Welcome back to Wonks, and Someone is standing from the audience in front of us, wants to ask a question. May we have your name?
My name is Amy Schmelzer.
Do you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Have I ever told the truth?
Go ahead.
Or not cause trouble?
Amy Schmelzer, go ahead.
So my question is a kind of a return to a topic in the previous segment about party control, and specifically has to do with Bernie Sanders, who ran kind of for the Democratic nomination for president, but was never really a Democrat.
Kind of, sort of,
not really. Still an independent, still the independent senator from Vermont. So what kind of control does the party have over a situation like that? Do they have any? Is there, you know, the whole issue of Hillary Clinton's apparatus being kind of kicking him in the rear, does it really matter? He wasn't a Democrat. That's my question.
This is definitely a Sue Dvorsky answer.
Well, the party control, and, you know, God knows I love to hog a mic, but I'm going to say to the only two normal Republicans left, maybe in the 3 million people that live in Iowa at this table. So we have to be... We have to be extremely respectful and careful of them, but I don't know. Donald Trump's not a Republican either. So I would suggest that both these campaigns this time showed the really severe limits of what party control is. Senator Sanders is not a Democrat. He is proud not to be a Democrat. He doesn't say he's a Democrat, and he ran for the nomination. And in many precincts, ours being one, in many places, beat the living bejesus out of the candidate who had spent her entire life working for the party and working at all levels of it. So I don't know. I mean, that tells me. Donald Trump.
He's a Democrat.
Yeah, he kind of is.
No, he's,
although
no,
we don't want him either.
Donald
Trump is sui generis. He's not whatever he is. But he ran in the Republican nomination and won it, and he's not a Republican. So I don't know what
comes
it says
back,
about either one.
This comes back to the money conversation that we were having. Actually, there is an explanation for this. It goes back to McCain-Feingold. It goes back to Watergate. And then you add in things like Citizens United, Buckley-Vileo. We have basically...
It definitely goes back to Watergate.
We've destroyed... everything.
Everything goes back to Watergate.
So we've destroyed the party system in a very systematic way over time with every decision that we've made, some of them well-intended, some of them not... necessarily well-intended or intended at all for the, you know, Citizens United. But all of these things have sort of progressed along to the point where now the parties literally do not have any power. What we control now is some coordinated budgets, a little bit of voter contact and turnout. We control, to some extent, the events that candidates get invited to. We control a little bit about the primary calendars and the caucus calendars and that
debates.
Sort of thing. Debates. But for the most part, the action is outside of the parties. The parties don't have control. It's been drained from them through a series of actions, some of which were well-intended and some of which were not. And that's why we're here. And it's probably not going to go back. The parties are not going to rise up, form up, and get stronger again in place of these other outside movements and candidates who are simply bigger than their parties.
But then what happens, because Dave and Jeff are talking about a rarefied level of presidential politics that only comes up every 4 years. But David and I, we're working at the state level. And so what happens to the Iowa legislature? What happens to the House races, the Senate races at the state level? What happens when we're trying to run a statewide run for Senate? U.S. Senate's probably different, but the governor's race is not different. So what happens when the parties have been crushed by the presidential race every 4 years, which used to be designed to build the party and move you to the next 4 years, and now is so utterly decoupled? That, I think, is a tremendous deleterious impact on the local, on the ground.
You know, the Iowa caucuses, though, aid and abet this in a little, in some ways, because it makes it possible for people who are outside of their party apparatus, who are black sheeps, and can build a following and have a good message and can start winning elections in Iowa. So even though these started off as being party building functions, that it really does provide a stepping stone for people who might be outside their party.
One way to raise money, as we saw last weekend, is with celebrities, with the fall gala for the Democratic Party. But we also see tons of celebrities come in to campaign. You know, Katy Perry was here for Hillary Clinton. There have been famous names. Well, I mean, celebrities also running for office. Talk a little bit, if you would, about whether celebrities are worth does it pay off or not? Anybody?
We have better celebrities. You might have more money.
Suit.
We totally have better
great.
Celebrities. No,
here
we
go. Great to be a Republican because we get Meatloaf.
Kid Rock.
I love Kid Rock.
We got Scott Baio.
Ted Nugent.
I mean,
so proud. It must have
Sean
been such
Hannity.
A moment.
Come on.
We got better celebrities. They got more money, but we got better celebrities. And yeah, it does matter because it's fun. You know, the fall gala. Don't ask. Don't at me. This week with Alec Baldwin.
It'll always be the JJ dinner to me.
Commonly referred to as the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner.
Until we get a better one. Yeah. That was fun. It was on message, and it was a great. His speech was to die for. He did a great job.
Different speeches.
Totally different speeches. Alec Baldwin. But when he started, they put 3,000 people in that room. That was the third biggest fall gala that's ever happened in an off, you know, what we used to call an off year. No more of those. But it was terrific. It was exciting and fun and something different. Troy Price, chair of the Iowa Democratic Party, shout out to him. He made a great decision, and it was super fun. And if you get when Oprah came in for Obama, Jiminy Christmas, we had Republicans quietly wearing like the false nose and glasses trying to get in the back door just to see Gail King. Oh, yeah. Sure, Dave. Whatever.
Dave looked great in them.
He looked so cute. So, yeah, I think it can be when Katy Perry came. That's fun. It doesn't always. You can get a celebrity. Again, when you talk about controlling message, you talk about it can be dangerous stuff. You know, because you just don't quite know.
It could still be dangerous if you brought Franken back again.
David Oman.
Thanks, Dave.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
All right.
Let's start on the Roy Moore conversation.
I'll raise you, Kevin
Spacey. Last question, right?
Yeah. Pivoting a little bit.
David wanted to make a point.
Oh, sorry.
Well,
about Roy Moore?
No. But you'll interpret this as being close enough for feedback. But I remember when I was co-chair in 87, we had the 88th cycle underway, and Pat Robertson dropped by the State Central Committee one day, and I'd known him and his son better through the cable business, and he had the 700 Club and all the rest, and he was actually a very charming guy. His father had been a senator, and I don't normally share bathroom conversations, but he and I took a break at the same time.
Oh, God.
And he was,
this does not relate to Roy Moore.
I leaned over to him, and I said, Pat, you ought to come out to Iowa sometime and raise some money for the Republican Party. And he leaned back and said, David, you couldn't spend all the money I'd raise. And we didn't bring him out.
Time,
we didn't bring him out either.
Good idea.
At the time, he was raising a lot of money.
That's what he did every day. That's
having right. celebrities come for political events sometimes causes tension in the newsroom. We almost had a rebellion at the Register when Bruce Springsteen came, and he actually performed in Iowa as well, but he did a concert in the Twin Cities for the Democratic Party. And to buy a ticket would be a donation to the Democratic Party. And so in their wisdom, our newsroom management said, you know, unless you're covering the event, you cannot go as a member of the public because, you know, we don't want our news staff contributing to political campaigns directly or indirectly. Almost caused a riot because some of our staff members were huge Springsteen fans, didn't care about the politics at all, just wanted to see the boss. No, they didn't get to go.
You know, when we have the caucuses and they're over, I always keep telling myself one of these days, the morning after caucuses, I'm going to go out to the airport, and I fully expect to see at the end of the runway, tearfully waving goodbye would be the hotel owners and the restaurant owners, sobbing as all their people leave. Kathy, can you give us some estimate of, and this is a hard figure to come up with, what kind of money is spent in the state simply on the caucuses?
Yeah, well, we hear the chambers, you know, give some sort of economic And I can't, maybe one of you guys can come up with a number. I can't off the top of my head. There is an economic impact on Iowa. It's not why Iowa has the caucuses. Sometimes that gets brought up as a reason for Iowa to continue to have the caucuses. That's not why. But it does help the state in the sense of, you know, you've got stories in the New York Times about, guess what, people, there's actually great restaurants in Iowa. There's actually interesting things going on in Iowa. Des Moines is a great city. And so those kinds of things you can't really buy. I mean, that's just excellent. Gives our state a great rep around the country. The rest of it, the hotels, et cetera, yes, there is some money there, but I don't know that it's necessarily a reason to have the caucus.
That's one area Republicans and Democrats do agree on. They love being able to have Iowa's role in the caucuses.
At the microphone is
Tiffany Tauschek with the Greater Des Moines Partnership, and we agree. We love having the caucuses here. So my colleague Sophia Ahmad and I were just remembering back in the last caucus when, yes, we had all of these celebrities in and all of this money coming in because the news media love to just infiltrate the city. They're going to bars and restaurants and bars. There's a lot of that. But in addition to that, we have such an opportunity as a community to really roll out that red carpet and show those media what it's like to live in our community and experience our community. I mean, heck, we went out shopping for high heel booty boots for Mika from Mika and Joe. She literally handed over hundreds of dollars and said, I need new shoes for the band. So these are the sorts of experiences that we wouldn't get to experience and we wouldn't get to help tell the story of our fantastic city if it were not for the Iowa caucuses.
Right. Tiffany, thank you.
I think there's another thing here too. You look at the RFS for in the last week or two, the renewable fuel standard, which was upheld. Scott Pruitt, who is the EPA director, does not like it. Neither does Ted Cruz. Neither do a lot of other politicians who represent oil,
like Donald Trump.
And Donald Trump was the person, because of the Iowa caucuses, I think more than any other reason, who said, we're not going to touch the RFS. You talk about bringing money into the state. That's hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue over a long period of time. And it's also millions and millions of investment that is now more secure and more stable because of policies like that. So it's not just the visits that we get, it's also the policy impact that a place like Iowa can have by convincing candidates to get on board with something like the RFS and stick with it.
Talk a little bit about what it has been spent on, because I know, I mean, you think TV ads and you think print ads and you think travel and things like this, but I'm sure there have been a few things that have come up that you've had to spend money on, or incidents that have come up that weren't necessarily under the purview of typical campaign expenses. Come on.
Sure. I don't know if the statutes run on some of these.
Well, let's see. I remember getting a call 45 days after the caucuses from Mitt Romney's political director saying, oh, crap, I forgot my rental car in the Marriott parking lot in January, and this was in March or February or something like that. So I had to pay about $500 to get it out of hock and then take it back. But, you know, I mean, the money that gets spent on snow shovels in 2008 in a caucus that didn't snow.
Okay, explain this, because I...
This is a Sioux story, I think, more because we didn't do this on the Republicans.
Oh, no.
Don't really.
Lincoln and I were Obama, sort of, but at that time, Senator Clinton, mm-hmm. Senator yeah. Clinton, who maybe I think working in that campaign in 2016, I think she learned some important things and things changed. I was not at that campaign in 2008, but I was in the gym at Coralville Central when the snow shovels were delivered. Which was kind of goofy because that night it was like
58 degrees.
Yeah, it was 58 degrees. There had not been snow for a week, and there was no snow forecast for ages. We, on the other hand, were bringing in coloring sheets and crayons to keep the kids busy and sandwiches to feed everybody, which seemed like a better campaign expenditure at the time. So
Iowans tend to have David's their own snow
caffeine.
Shovels as well. I mean, it's not like people needed a flimsy campaign shovel to get to the caucuses.
Well, money gets David spent Oman. On trinkets and little things like that we were chatting earlier that usually is money that's wasted. It's vanity stuff for the candidate to see his or her name. But the real money does go to television. Let's just own that. There's a reason Hearst owns WMUR in Manchester and KCCI here. I just remember when I ran for office, you know, how hard it was, this 20 years ago sometimes, to get $1,000. You'd meet somebody, you'd make your case, you'd ask for the money, you'd get the check, phone call, back and forth. And then you come home at the end of the day, maybe make it home by 10 o'clock, flip on the news, and you see your ad. And back then it was $1,000 for a 30-second spot. It was gone in 30 seconds, like the movie title.
And you had to pay cash for it, didn't you?
The money's up front, that's right. But you thought, God, that was fast, you know. And now it's a lot more expensive, and the revenue numbers are incredibly high.
At the microphone.
My name is Amy Albert, and I am retired. Full disclosure, I'm a diehard Democrat. And I would like to bring up the NRA and how helpless we feel as a voter in trying to get any kind of gun control, because we feel like our representatives are bought and sold and owned by the NRA. And even though I read countless surveys that indicate 80%, very high majority of people are for some kind of common sense gun control, and the Congress, the state is not any better. The state is letting anybody have a weapon. They're going to have them in kindergarten pretty soon. It's very frustrating. And what would you advise a common citizen to do in trying to combat that big, what I call dark money?
Who wants to take that one?
Well, I will.
Go ahead.
I'll start with that and say that the currency that matters most in that circumstance is not a dollar bill. Mm-hmm. It's the vote.
Vote.
And it's a fact that people who are NRA members and oppose what you would consider to be sensible gun control are much more highly organized, much more intensely motivated than people who oppose that, believe it or not. And so what the NRA can do, it's one of the classic cases of lobbying influence in the United States, they can motivate all these supporters to turn on a dime, whatever they're doing, and flood congressional offices with emails and texts and letters and things and phone calls and so forth. And so when you talk about the representatives, I think it's not that they're bought and sold in monetary terms. It's just those folks vote. It's a characteristic of the American political system that a smaller group of people who are intensely motivated can win out over a larger group of people who are not as intensely motivated. That's a feature of the political system.
A lot of heads nodding over
yes.
here.
No, and
Jeff Link.
Here's what I would say. You're asking the question is step one. Right? Come to events like this, ask this question, because it's ridiculous what's going on in this country with guns. And, you know, I might characterize it as gun safety as opposed to gun control, but, you know, asking these questions in forums like this is really important, because that's what happens on the other side of this debate, and we don't ever get anyone asking a question about how are we going to deal with gun safety. Because that's what we really need.
Sue Tversky.
And I was going to say, you have to vote. We had, at the state level and at the federal level right now, we have lost, partisan hat here, we have lost all the balance that we had. The state was a purple state for a very long time. It's never been a blue state. You know, when we're lucky, we're at purple. When we had that, in both the legislature and in the executive offices, and we go back and forth, we have better public policy, and I really do believe that. That is not a partisan thing. What we have now is one-party control in a party that is a little bit run amok. That's my opinion of it. But we have one-party control at both the federal and state level, and so the conversation has gotten completely out of whack.
There's a bit of a messaging problem on the Democratic side on this issue as well. There will be a ballot initiative on the ballot in 2020, in Iowa, I believe, that will marry up Iowa's Constitution with the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and I guarantee you it will get 65% to 70% of the vote.
Yeah.
One of the factors...
The voters aren't with you on this issue.
Right.
Now,
right.
Because you've lost the messaging war at this point. I think you can get, you can find polling that can get people to agree to sensible gun reforms up into the 60s and 70s. The problem is that the entire message environment is against gun control, and it's not changing anytime soon, I don't think, until Democrats learn how to play a different playbook. And Republicans, frankly, need to be a little bit bolder and step out after some of these shootings and say, well, we can't talk about this now, which is when we should be talking about it. I mean, I'm kind of a liberal on this. I believe in the Second Amendment. I believe in, I don't own a gun, but I definitely am a Second Amendment supporter. I do think that this is one that Democrats lost a long time ago and haven't ever been able to find a voice to figure out how to go back and change real persuadable voters. Because I can tell you in 3 years, when that ballot initiative is on the ballot in Iowa, it will pass in Iowa, and it will be a strongly pro-gun amendment.
Here's a reminder to check out our website, iowawonks.com. We have links to subscribe to our podcasts, the latest news about the next Wonks Live show, including the topics and the panelists for the coming month. You can also link to Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and more to subscribe to our monthly big show and weekly little Wonks, short little podcasts that are just a few minutes long. And remember, iowawonks.com, and like Iowa Wonks on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. We're going to continue with our microphone from the studio audience, and we have at the microphone
Mike Lowen. Earlier, David had mentioned that the big money goes to TV, and with the advent of, you know, things like Netflix and people just watching less TV and the rise of social media, where do you see the money going in the future with MicroStrategy, analytics, and things like that? You think there's going to be a divestiture towards that sort of strategy?
I think you answered your own question.
Probably.
Jeff, do you want to take a stab at that? Because I know you've worked on a variety of different campaigns that have dealt with that.
No. So you're absolutely right. You know, back in the golden age, maybe in the 80s and 90s, you could buy the three network news broadcasts and you'd get maximum reach, right? Because in advertising, there's two things, reach and frequency. Mm-hmm. And so reach, you would buy broadcast television. That's how you got everybody. Now you have fewer people watching broadcast news. You have more people watching Netflix, Hulu, you name it. They're watching on devices instead of on TVs. But, you know, you have to buy those devices. And you can now. And, in fact, everyone leaves a digital trail. And whether it's with cable, as David knows, if you have a smart box on your cable device, not only does the programming come into your box, but your viewership goes back out the pipe. And so the cable companies know what you're watching and when you're clicking on one thing or another. And they can sell that data because you agreed to it in your user agreement. And then companies like one that I ran for 4 years buy that data, and we can target ads to specific households. And so, like, if Sue and I lived on the same street, I could buy her cable box and not mine, right? Not even buying programs like you used to do. So the whole way of buying advertising, whether it's digital or television, has totally changed even in the last 8 years.
And what has suffered? What, in other words, what don't you buy anymore? Everything from yard signs to radio to...
Well, I'll give you one example from Obama 2012. In Obama 2012, the Obama campaign bought things based on these, looking at the set-top box data from people. The Romney campaign bought cable the old way. And so we had targets that were, for instance, younger male. Now, everyone out here could answer this question. If you want to buy younger male audience, what do you think you buy on cable?
Sports.
ESPN. What's the most expensive advertising property on cable? ESPN. Okay, we knew that we had younger male targets who were watching the Sci-Fi Channel and other channels at the long tail of cable because we were looking at this granular data. And so Romney, because he had a lot of money, could buy ESPN. We were buying Sci-Fi. And so the Obama campaign bought 60 cable networks nationally. The Romney campaign bought 16. We could name all 16. It's all the cable nets, all the sports nets, Lifetime, and a couple others. And so that's how you make adjustments for the new...
Tell us about the video games.
The other thing we did, and this was back in 2008, David alluded to this earlier, that Obama had a lot more money than John McCain. And so we had literally so much money, we were buying billboard ads within video games because we had targets that were younger and male, and we knew they were playing a lot of video games. And whether it's Microsoft or any of the other gaming platforms, they sell ads within the game. And we were buying Obama ads within games.
So you're talking like Mario Kart, you're racing, and there's an Obama, literally an Obama billboard or
yes,
something on the side.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
I need, before we get to your question, I just want to make sure we do this, because these guys are wizards, and in some senses, because it's Iowa and first in the nation, they've invented some of this stuff on the digital stuff. But the other place that money goes and always has gone, and my man Daniel Wast is out here, so somebody's got to say this. These guys are digital guys. This is what they do. But it goes, the other place it goes is into field. It goes into human beings, mostly young, and it goes into so that when they get the cable box on the street and they know they have my cable box, that really doesn't do anything until Daniel or Andrew or somebody else, I can't see all who's out here, comes and knocks at my door and drags my vote out. Now, that's why it's so expensive, because I'm not a person that has to be dragged out, but my neighbor is. So is everybody else, apparently. It's people. So you're buying the chum and the stuff like that. That's incidental money. But you're buying message and communication out, and you're buying people so that they can go to where those ads went, get those people, and get them voted.
We're going to turn to our panelists now for a final thought, overall, serious, humorous, whatever they wish.
Kathy Money Obradovich. And politics.
Right. Yes. Well, as a journalist, I've never actually contributed to a candidate. So, I used to feel like I was getting a pass, that I didn't have to do that. Now I kind of wish I could. But the point I would make to all of you who want to see things change in money and politics is work on the people in your own party. A lot of the stories that we write about money and politics is people in one party pointing a finger at the people in the other party and saying, isn't this terrible? But really where you can have influence is the people in your own party, and work on them.
Sue Dvorsky.
We talked about being cynical. I would suggest this. Be skeptical. Don't be cynical. This is our system. The way we save this system is voting. That's your vote's more important than your money. Your money's more important than your apathy, in that order. So don't be cynical. He's not. Dave Kochel is not cynical. But be skeptical and ask the people in your own party.
Dave Kochel.
I would say let's get back to parties again. I mean, I'm a party person. Let's make sure that we find anything that we can do that strengthens the role of the party, which means also the grassroots. Not the smoke-filled rooms, not the establishment, not any of these buzzwords that get thrown around. But the parties are a check against some of the wilder swings that we see in terms of how our candidates rise up and take over and where movements come from. The parties are the place I think we need to see strengthened. And what's happened over the past 20 or 25 years has undermined them, and I don't think that's a healthy thing.
Jeff Link.
First of all, Dave is totally cynical. Second of all, here's the one thing I would ask everyone to consider promoting. We need transparency in disclosure of contributions, whether it's from super PACs or in campaigns. Let me give you one specific example. We have a primary going on for governor of the state of Iowa right now. We have seven Democrats running. We have two Republicans running. In the year of 2017, not one candidate has reported one contribution or one expenditure yet this year, because they're not required to by law. that is nuts. They should be required to do this monthly, mm-hmm. at least quarterly, mm-hmm. but literally in the entire year of 2017, no one has reported anything. We're not going to know what anyone has done until the middle of January.
David Oman.
Or just do it immediately.
Sure.
Literally yeah. online that night. It's absolutely doable. Look, I agree with reinvesting in the parties. I've said that. I believe it. I always will believe it. We need to take some of the pressure off the candidates. We're so spoiled here. We expect every candidate running from top down to come into every county every year, see everybody, make all those phone calls. We need more people like us to volunteer, help people. You lost a great candidate for Congress in Mike Sherzan, who ran in 16, came in second to Maurer, and thought about running this time, and then was called by the DCCC and said, you've got to spend 7-8 hours a day on the phone. He said, the hell with that. I'm not going to do that. And that means someone has to do it, and I think more people like us. Amy, you're concerned about your issues. We got to dive in. We got to help these people so they can have some time to meet people and listen and think about a vision and articulate that. They'll be a better candidate if they do that and a better office holder if they win.
Yes.
You're here. And that is another Wonks. Our thanks to our panelists, David Oman, Jeff Link, Kathy Obradovich, Dave Kochel, and Sue Dvorsky. We're also especially grateful to Maria Filippone, Max Wellman, and Brandon Gedler, and all the folks here at Noche Jazz Cabaret. Josh Jepson up there is our audio engineer. Alex Cooney is in charge of iowawonks.com and creates our graphics. Our special thanks to the likes of Matt Paul, Matt Strawn, and Ann Selzer, who contribute to this program. Bob Thomas wrote our theme music. Rob Davis is our executive producer. Dennis Goldford is far too smart to be a part of this, but he does it anyway out of the goodness of his heart. I'm Kevin Cooney. Thank you all here at Noche for being a part of Wonks.